All right, this is Gnostic Media Podcast, episode number 179, with your host, Jan Irvin, and I'm with Bert doing this intro for this episode today. Hey, Bert.
Hey, howdy, Jan, and howdy, folks.
And so, all right, Bert, we're doing this episode that we're titling Corporate Abortion. So why don't you tell the audience why this episode is important?
Well, the most important point that we want to hopefully have people walk away with here is to try to comprehend that when we stand in any court, there is no way that we can stand in court against or prosecuting a piece of property. And when we think about corporations, that's actually what they are. They are something that are owned by usually more than one man or woman, and it's something that can be dismantled, and in fact, you can compare it to being aborted. So it's a person that can be aborted, which actually fits a much better definition of any legislation dealing with abortion, because abortion actually relates to aborting persons, and real men and women or real children are not persons, but a corporation, in fact, is. And we're going to discuss the meaning of a citizen of the United States, meaning a citizen of the States United, within the true meaning of the Constitution.
All right. And did you want to touch on any of the other points here that will be covered? Or do you think that's a thorough enough summary and we'll leave it for the audience? I mean, you know, such as all corporations are property, a corporation is property, etc.
Yeah, I think we'll touch on those points as we go through the podcast, and the people can just follow along and see the points that we'll be hitting as we go through this podcast.
And there will be some notes up on the website for this episode for those of you who would like further research and donations. This episode is brought to you by Janaea, Tad, Paul, Max, Lewis, Oscar, Michael, Stephen, David, Eric, Thomas, John, Joseph, M&A, Crystal, Aaron, and Evo. Thanks to all of you for making this episode happen. And of course, like we say each episode, we do our best to provide just about everything here for free, so your donations and website purchases are greatly appreciated. The show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And of course, the views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. The website, www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. Contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And I will put, I don't have Bert and Tom's websites in front of me, so those will be up on the website as well. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here is my conversation with Bert, Tom, and John titled Corporate Abortion. Enjoy.
So are we ready to get into this thing here, this one paper?
We are. Why don't you, do you want to just kick it off, Bert, and let everybody know first what we're going to be covering? What is this paper that you sent to all of us and why we're all here today?
Yeah, this is basically to discuss one very important point, or at least to me it's important, and that is that in much of the cases that we are involved in, we are not aware of the fact that we're actually dealing with a plaintiff, or in some cases a defendant, that in fact has no standing in court against the people. And this particular paper is about a case that we are involved in, involving a giant corporation known as City Mortgage, And this is actually being argued in a federal court. And some of the conclusions that we are passing on here is based on the very Constitution and opinions of the United States Supreme Court. So I think it's very, you know, the main reason I wanted to do this is so that people will realize that when they go to court, they really have to have an understanding, comprehension of who they are, so that they are not tricked into either elevating the opponent's status to a status that they actually cannot hold, and to prevent themselves from being lowered to a status which they themselves should not hold. So when we go into court, we must maintain ourselves at the proper status, and that is a citizen according to the meaning of the Constitution. Because there are actually more than one type of citizen in this great nation known as the United States of America. And if we don't know which is the citizenship status that we're holding, then we're pretty much confused and at the mercy of the attorneys and the complicity of the judges when we enter this courtrooms. Now, Tom has gone through this thing with me, and he has helped me to try to get this point across. Tom, any other point that we should highlight before we actually go through it?
The more I think about this document, the essential thing in it is the sequence of events. So which citizenship came first? And that would be the one defined in the Constitution. And then you have the 14th Amendment citizenship coming along, citizen of the United States, subsequent to that. But that didn't change the original Constitution citizen.
And may I ask a question here?
Yeah.
Does the Articles of Confederation come in here anyplace?
Is yes.
There a citizenship?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
So and that's even prior to the Constitution.
Right.
And so if you, a lot of people think that citizen of the United States under the 14th Amendment cancels out what went before, but it doesn't at all. And it can't be canceled out by the word citizen appearing in statutes, because statutes don't change the Constitution and they don't change the Articles of Confederation, which are still in effect. So when I read this document, I keep in mind the sequence of events, and what follows subsequently does not change the original meaning as the Constitution was written and the Articles of Confederation were written. So I would just add that, Bert, as an important way to focus on the document.
Okay,
I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. So let's go through it, and then John and Jan can you know, jump in to help us clarify any particular
right
point.
And so, and just make sure that we're all muted when we're not talking.
Okay. So the very and this is part of a longer document, but I just basically took out the part that deals with the federal government. But I also brought in into this thing state regulations and state constitution. But anyway, so the big point here is enter claimants herein claim that City Mortgage has no standing in this court. Therefore, their request and original action must be dismissed and enter claimant's action remanded to the Minnesota District Court of General Jurisdiction for proper due process. And this here is based on the following, which is the next point that we're going to cover. But this very first thing that we read here is kind of quite a bit in itself for most people. because most people don't comprehend what standing is,
and they don't, they also don't understand that the federal court is of a limited jurisdiction and not general jurisdiction.
Do you want to define mm-hmm. standing first?
You want to tackle standing, Tom?
I could. You might do it better, though.
Well, go ahead, and then I'll add it.
Okay. By the way, the noise in the background is actually a floor fan that's running that I think you're hearing.
Can you kill it?
I can, but I'll be sweating bullets in here. So.
Boy, I understand that. Now, leave the fan in. We can take it out.
Okay. Standing is whether you have the right to be in a court. And if you don't have that right to be in a court, you shouldn't be there and they shouldn't be doing anything. So, for example, early on, people started to challenge Obama's legitimacy in federal court. And all those cases were dismissed because the plaintiff didn't have standing to bring the complaint. And they weren't affected directly by the complaint. So you have to be in a court properly, you have to have standing to be there. So you'd have to be a citizen of the United States in the 14th Amendment sense to have standing in a federal court. I don't know what else to add to that, but technical stuff.
Yeah, I mean, according to the dictionaries, it says like standing to be sued. It, according to Fifth Black's Law, it says capacity of a person or sovereign to be a party defendant in an action. So basically, you have to have a dog in the fight. Okay, if you have no dog in the fight, it means nothing. Now, here's another definition of that, and I sent that to everybody. A party's right to make a legal claim or seek judicial enforcement of a duty or right. To have standing in federal court, a plaintiff must show that the challenged conduct has caused the plaintiff actual injury. So you have to have some kind of injury. Mm-hmm. That the interest sought to be protected is within the zone of interest meant to be regulated by the statutory or constitutional guarantee in question.
Hmm. A good example of that is in Florida, for example, it used to be that you could sue for alienation of affection. So if some guy went off to the service and came back and his wife was having an affair with somebody else, he had standing. He was injured by that, by loss of companionship, and he had standing to sue in the Florida courts. They've now changed that. You can't do that. If that scenario happened again, that man would not be considered legally injured, and so he can't go into a court and claim compensation for alienation of affection. So that would be a practical example of that.
Yeah, and then
now,
here's,
let me just say now, that's a kind of an interesting one because essentially what that is an appeal to emotion, isn't it? Injury by lack of affection.
Yeah, but it used to be a cause of action in Florida, but it no longer is.
Right. I'm just saying it's an interesting thing because it's based on an appeal to emotion there. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, here's another example. It says, have the appellant alleged such a personal stake in the outcome of the controversy as to assure that concrete adverseness, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly, which sharpens the presentation of issues upon which the court so largely depends for illumination of difficult constitutional questions. This is the gist of the question of standing, Baker versus Carr, a U.S. case. So you have to have a personal stake in the outcome of the controversy. And then the other part of the equation is, can the court hear that particular type of case?
Now, sure. Now, like, so let me just interject here, Bert, because now, so what you're saying is, one, they have to show that they have standing in that court. Two, they have to show that they were injured to be in that court, correct? And so, obviously, a corporation, because it doesn't exist, can't be injured. Would that be correct?
Well, I mean, the corporation, that's what we're going to get into there. A corporation is, in fact, nothing more than a property. Now, if I have a chair and I cut one of its legs off, I mean, can you argue that the chair was damaged? Well, the chair was damaged from the perspective of it being a piece of property. Now it's no longer a chair because it doesn't have four legs. But can it be injured in the same way that you would injure a man or woman if you
now,
cut his
what
or her
about,
legs off?
What about the difference between a company and a corporation? Because a corporation is incorporated or embodied so that none of the people below it have to take responsibility for that corporation's actions. And then the corporation itself, even though a fictional god entity, is then considered a person, right?
Would you say a physical god? So you're saying that a man
well,
can
they,
be a
they
person?
Create, no, what I'm saying is they create the corporation to take responsibility away from the men. They incorporate or embody that what was a company into a corporation, and then they give it personhood status.
Well, I mean, that's, and I think a lot of that stuff is a myth, and a lot of it is just legal manipulation of statutes, of regulations. Because if you create something and then you use it to harm or cause fraud, I mean, how can that possibly relieve you of any liability? So it's
right.
So
well,
it's,
I mean,
it's,
we
it's
have.
True.
We have Monsanto and all of these types of companies all over the place right now. And, you know, companies dumping fluoride in the water and whatnot. And none of that is to our health benefit.
Right. Well, so the point is that just because you have a business or you have a corporation, if you are, in fact, the owner of that property, I mean, just like if you own a dog and the dog is vicious and the dog, you know, you're careless in the management of that dog and that dog bites someone. Well, the dog itself is just a dog. So who's liable for the dog? It's the owner.
The owner, yeah. The owner of the property, yeah.
The owner of the property. The property itself has no liability. It's just property.
So how do you go out, you know, because, you know, we all know that corporate guys get away with this stuff all the time. So anyway, and I don't want to go too far away here, but how do we get them back? Do we go after the person who filed the corporate charter?
That's what we're going to get into here, because as we clarify some of these points, some of this, you know, it will enlighten some of these points that you're bringing up, because those are all critical points that you're bringing up, and that has been the illusion that we have been taught from, you know, most of us from first grade.
Yeah.
To believe all these fallacies that like you bring up, and as we go through this thing, I would like you to high point, you know, or highlight some of your teachings to eliminate fallacies as we go through this thing. You know?
And as we do go through it, what you'll find out is City Mortgage claims an injury, but they fabricated the injury, so they don't have standing in the court.
How did they fabricate the injury?
Well, why don't we go through it and you know, follow along, and it'll be, it's pretty short actually.
Yeah, and we can always, of course, come back. But any critical questions, feel free to jump in. So then, the other point that we brought up in here was says therefore their request and original action must be dismissed and the injured action remanded back to Minnesota, okay, which is a court of general jurisdiction. So. If you look at the Constitution, it says that you have the Supreme Court and those inferior courts, which Congress may designate or create, right? So they're telling you right there that they're inferior courts. By definition, an inferior court is a court of limited jurisdiction. And a perfect example of that is a traffic court. A traffic court is an extremely limited jurisdiction court. You're not going to go into traffic court and say, hey, yeah, that guy, you know, painted my house the wrong color and, you know, I'm suing him. They're going to say, like, man, you're in the wrong court. We're only here to deal with traffic issues. hey, he murdered my wife. You're in the wrong court, bud. We can't hear your case.
He has no standing.
Yeah, you cannot have standing in this court because we are not authorized to hear your particular type of case. Okay? So what has happened in this particular case, and this is actually what they are doing, even in state, within the state, they are removing you or preventing you from being in a court of general jurisdiction, which means unlimited jurisdiction, and then they're moving you into a court of limited jurisdiction. And whenever you are basically stepped down from a general jurisdiction court to one of limited, they're actually limiting your rights. They're limiting your due process. They're limiting everything about your case because there's going to be certain issues that you're not going to be able to bring up in this inferior court due to the fact that it's limited. But in an unlimited court, you can bring in anything related to your case, and the referee then will have to deal with it with objections from the other side to determine whether in fact the issues that you're bringing into the court are so way off left field that they really have nothing to do with the case. Okay, but just from a jurisdictional point of view of the court, they cannot just straight out say, oh, I'm sorry, we can't hear that because it's not within the jurisdiction. And that's the big difference between being in a limited court and being in one that's not limited.
And that's the basis for a judge excluding evidence that might have a different outcome if it was presented to the jury.
Mm-hmm. So does that point make sense there, John?
John, you there? Did we lose John?
Sorry, no, I was muted. yes, it does. It does make sense.
Mm-hmm. So it's okay. So let's move on.
What's the part that makes sense, John? I'm curious.
Well, I was listening to Bert. I didn't actually read the part here. I don't know what you're reading, but I'm listening to his explanation. That's what I'm referring to. The fact that you want to be in a general jurisdiction, you want to be able to bring in anything that you want to use to defend yourself is what I'm understanding.
Hey, John, would you like to introduce yourself for the audience quickly?
Okay. I live in Riverside, California. I'm ex-military, ex-medical background. I've been in the financial business, basically the insurance kind of business and financial planning stuff for the last 30 years, and have just come to the conclusion that it's all that time is wasted. You can't build wealth. You can't really control a lot. And so I've been spending my time trying to learn legal matters, which I believe are the things that the education I never got, the real education. And we've inherited a bunch of property, and I've been having to go out there and protect it from the government and deal with courts and deal with tax issues. And I find myself embroiled in all these controversies.
Yeah.
The least of which is, getting the proper sheriff so we have proper law protection, because the sheriff and the law, the legal people that are out there enforcement, are running over everybody.
Right.
So I'm not as experienced in this stuff at all as with Bert.
Yeah.
Bert, you want to continue?
Okay. Have you? I put the documents in here. We're reviewing. I don't know if. If everybody downloaded it. Well, it says three completed, so I'm assuming that John had it so that he can kind of read along.
Yeah, I got it.
We have session and we have standing.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right, cool. So then, so this is the thing. The supposed plaintiff has no standing in this court or any court against injured claimant due to the following undeniable facts. Now, these are just facts that if someone wants to argue, well, I don't see how they're going to be able to overcome this fact. Okay. So number one is City Mortgage is in fact property. Okay. What are some of the definitions of property? It's something that can be bought and sold, right? So in the next point, we say City Mortgage Inc. is property and therefore cannot be a citizen within the meaning of the Constitution as explained in detail within the opinions of the United States Supreme Justices in the case U.S. Supreme Court versus Scott versus Sanford. 1856. That is such a beautiful case that everyone really needs to study in great detail. There is so much, I mean, super valuable information either explaining so many different points. And the way this case was presented to me when I was in school was, oh, this was all about slavery, and you know, this is what stimulated the Civil War and all this bunch of nonsense. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with two very important subjects, and one was property, and the other one was citizenship. What was a citizen of the United States within the meaning of the Constitution? And you know, John brought up the Articles of Confederation, and this justices bring up the Articles of Confederation, and they say the citizen, according to the meaning of the United States, cannot be anything else other than the citizen that existed at the time that those Articles of Confederation were put together.
Wow.
That is, in fact, the citizen that is meant within the meaning of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. And this decision, by the way, is called the Dred Scott decision.
So let's, you know, what I see here is what you guys are explaining is how this applies to a corporation is that a corporation was considered property. Now, before the Dred Scott decision, a slave, and in the Dred Scott decision, a slave was considered property. And right. So therefore, they had no standing in the court at that time. They weren't officially men. They were slaves. So
This
would apply to the corporation because the corporation is property. It's not a real human being, although the slaves were, you know, real humans, but the corporation isn't even an existing entity. It's just a phantom as it's defined. But so this property that is this corporation can be bought and sold, so therefore they have no standing or in this jurisdiction from that court.
Right. But didn't they correct that issue by claiming that or passing rules that said that the corporation is a person?
Yeah, that's kind of a miscomprehension of certain facts.
Okay.
And a person in law, in federal law, is always an artificial entity. So they never declared it to be human.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Congress, you know, if you look through the statutes, there is all kinds of statutes that refer to what a person is, and a corporation is included into that personhood. But a person within the, I mean, a citizen within the meaning of the Constitution does not include property. Now, in the commercial world, a corporation actually can even be considered a citizen of a particular state. And that's in the statute. But that's a different kind of citizen. That's not a citizen within the meaning of the Constitution. Okay, that's for commercial purposes. A corporation can be considered a citizen. And that's something totally different.
Okay, I got it.
And I know this gets kind of confusing because you have to always say you have to be a little schizophrenic to make sense of some of this stuff.
Yeah, but aren't they arguing this whole idea is in the commercial world, isn't it? You're trying to pull it out of the commercial side?
Well, and that's the thing is that there is definitely two worlds that we're dealing with here, and they all operate within the same body politic. But one world cannot supersede the other, and that is the commercial world cannot supersede the original intent of the body politic.
Okay, well, that's good to know because I've been trying to figure out how to operate in the private and still use the commercial side, and having
difficulty with that. Within the body politic, you have certain privileges that allows you to operate in commerce with the protection of the body politic. So there are certain privileges within that jurisdiction. But then there are certain inherent rights that you have to operate within commerce outside of the body politic that no one can regulate. Just like you and I can barter, you and I can enter into any contract that we want. And that becomes the law, and nobody politic can get involved in that unless it is some kind of a contract that is based on fraud, and then now I can seek the help of the body politic because you entered into fraud to cause me harm.
Well, that's right in the Constitution. No state can pass a law that interferes in the obligations of contracts.
Right.
That's private law. And then the sinking fund cases from the Supreme Court extended that to the federal government. And so the only person who could seek remedy from that would be if you committed fraud on somebody and they wanted remedy, then they would seek the jurisdiction of the court. But it would have to be a court that could hear the case.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's say it was election or voter fraud. Would that at all apply here, since the corporation would then be like a county?
Yeah, so the people who are running who are personally responsible for the fraud would have to be answerable, because the county itself, it's a fictional entity. They cannot it cannot do anything. It cannot sit on the stand. It cannot be questioned. So the myth and the game that attorneys want to get us into all the time is to get us to sue some fictional entity, because then it relieves the liability of the players.
So that's what I was getting at earlier that you just answered is, so what they do is, by creating this entity, they trick us into going after that instead of the human beings behind it. And then, you know, when the human beings can't be got from suing the god entity called a corporation, then, you know, of course, because that is just a piece of property, or it's just a piece of fairy tale, and it can't sit there in the court. And then what they do is they don't go after the president and the CEO and the COO, et cetera. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, they try to trick you into doing that. So if you're suing the corporation, then two things must happen in court. Either you're elevating that corporation to the position of a citizen within the meaning of the Constitution, which cannot be done, or you are lowering yourself to the level of the property, which actually you have a right to do. and then you go and hire an attorney, which then represents you in that capacity. And then now you have two things of equal status going against each other. And here's a key point to understand in all this stuff that involves court. People go into court and they argue that I am a flesh-breathing man, that I am a flesh-breathing dragon. None of that stuff matters. You could be a flesh-breathing dragon, okay? But if you have the proper status, that's all that counts. It's all about status, because in the body politic, it's a ladder with different rungs on it, right? And your rank within that body politic is what matters. And within the government of the United States, and within the government of any state or government of any source, everybody has a rank.
So what you're saying is that by this, you know, we did a show a few months back that we called the first day of consensual society or whatever it was, but with you and Dr. Tom here, and so this voluntary consensual society, what they're doing is they're essentially getting us to turn ourselves into the property of the corporation by signing and consenting to all of these licenses, marriage licenses, driver's licenses, and all of this stuff. So then, as you just said, we can volunteer to lower ourselves into the status of property. But would you agree with that, that by doing all of this and abiding by all of these codes and things, we're actually putting ourselves as property underneath this government corporation?
To some degree. You wanna add to that, Tom?
Yeah, I would just say yes to Jan. That mm-hmm. when you give you can't deal with the government without an application form. You always have to separate. And that becomes your law. When you apply for a driver's license, when you apply for a marriage license, the state isn't giving you those licenses. You're giving the state the license to regulate you because they can't do it without your consent. That's what the Declaration of Independence says, that the government can't exercise its powers without the consent of the governed. And so the way they get that consent is they get you to apply for Social Security, you apply for a driver's license, a marriage license, a professional license, and you're saying, okay, I'm giving you a license to regulate my activity. So you actually grant the license to the state.
So there's an inherent power of attorney we're giving them.
Yes.
And so then they can try and force Obama no care and stuff on us.
Yeah.
But can't we revoke those powers of attorney?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's what nobody's teaching.
In fact, to resign from Social Security, they even have a form. They don't put it on their website, but you have to know about it, and then you can go get it. So the Social Security number is your federal employee identification number. And right. So that's why they can come after you anywhere in the world and say you owe us taxes and so forth and so on, because you're a federal employee.
And so all of these expatriates that are all over the world that the feds are going after, if they file this document, then they are resigning as federal employees, and then the Fed can no longer go after them.
Yeah, that's right. If you file, Bert, stop me in time to go over not to get too far afield. But for example, if you file a 1040, it says at the top, U.S. individual tax return. There's an implied comma there that you're not paying attention to. Most people read that as United States personal tax return. But an individual in federal law is a federal employee defined under Title V, federal personnel. So it's U.S. individual tax return. So federal individual, federal employee tax return, because that's who the taxes are for the federal government employees, not for the general public, unless you apply. So you have to, you're always giving the government license.
So as soon as you sign that tax document and send it in, you've applied for them to do all of this to you.
You've signed it under penalty of perjury. And in doing so, you're committing perjury, because the IRS says you cannot believe anything they write or tell you. You can't use one word that they say or write to support a position. They tell you that right up front. They can lie like a rug, and you can never get any remedy for that, because they put you on notice.
The only way that you would have any recourse against them at any time is to make sure that you always have this resignation from the IRS and from the federal government on file.
Yeah.
What if they came after you? Would you just show that paper and say, I'm no longer...
Well, they can't come after you after they've accepted their own form.
They cannot.
No. I mean, they've accepted it. They have no standing to come after you.
So instead of filing taxes this year, next year, whatever, in April, you would just send that form to them instead?
Well, it's like going AWOL. When you go into the service, you sign a contract. And if they tell you you have to go to Afghanistan 3 times or Pakistan 3 times or Iraq 3 times, you have to go. You signed a contract. The point I'm trying to make here is like, and the way to make the point is, when Congress passes a bill, it only passes a bill. That's all it does. It's not a law when they vote on it. What has to happen?
We consent, right?
No, the president must put his signature on that bill.
Okay, right.
The Queen of England has to sign every piece of legislation before it becomes law. And that's true of us. Every time we put our signature on a piece of paper, we're making some kind of law to be governed by. If I apply for Harvard University Business School, I have to fill out an application and sign it. And that means I'm consenting to their policies to govern me. They can throw me out if I don't show up for classes or whatever their policy is.
Yeah,
your signature is your sovereign seal.
Yeah, yeah. And most people don't realize the power of their own signatures. So along the same lines of what you guys just highlighted, if we're talking about status, one example. I don't know who was it that used this example, but let's say I own a giant corporation, whatever it is. And one day I decide that I want to put on the uniform of the janitor. And I'm going to take on the position of the janitor. And I'm going to work as a janitor for a month. And I sign all the required paperwork for me to act as a janitor. So does that mean, first of all, that I cease to be the owner of the corporation? Of course not. I'm still the owner of the corporation. But by signing the paperwork, I agree to allow my managers to manage me as an employee, which means that by signing the necessary paperwork, I agree to abide by all the regulations of my corporation.
So now let me just interject here. Let's say we have a case of somebody who's an appointed person who should have been elected into a position. And so then he would fall under that as an employee then, right? And so, I mean, how would that work in that case? Would that apply there?
Well, if you're elected into a position, are you not taking on the employee capacity of being an employee for the people or that particular corporation or municipality?
Well, what I'm getting at, though, is that it says that somebody who is appointed is an employee, whereas the elected officials under, like, the county charter, for instance, have sort of a different status. You know, they're not employees under the county, per se.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So if you're elected as an official and you're working under the capacity of an elected official, then you're supposed to be working directly for the sovereigns who elected you. So that means that you're working for the people.
So they're not employees then?
No, so they're answerable to the people.
Right, okay. So then if you had an unlawful sheriff in place, he's an employee, and then he's not answerable to anybody but the codes of the corporation.
Well, and that's the problem that we have with the sheriffs. The sheriffs are an elected official, but yet they act like they're an employee of the corporation that's paying them.
Right.
And then their allegiance is to the corporation, not to the people.
Didn't the sheriff tell you that, Bert?
Yeah, I had a sheriff tell me that directly to my face.
That he works for the state.
Yeah. He says that that there is basically kind of like a romantic view of the common law sheriff, but in reality, his job is to enforce the statutes.
That's a pretty delusional sheriff there. I'm glad ours isn't that bad. Well, at least the one we're trying to get in, our sheriff in exile mm-hmm. right now is, mm-hmm. Anyway.
So the point to understand about this Dred Scott case is that Dred Scott was going into this federal court of limited jurisdiction and attempting to take on the status of a citizen of the United States within the meaning of the Constitution, which he could not due to the fact that he was considered property. Okay? And here's another point to take a little bit beyond that. Here we have, like you correctly said, Jan, a real man, okay, who could not even stand against a citizen of the United States within the meaning of the Constitution because he was considered property. Now we have a corporation, absolutely not a man, okay, trying to stand against other people who are just simply failing to stand in court as citizens of the United States within the meaning of the Constitution. I mean, that's a huge conflict right there. So anyway, moving on to the next one, he says, injured claimants in their capacity as one of the people have no standing in any forum or court against property that can be created by man, bought and sold, unless this court is placing injured claimants on the status of property. So, I mean, the court has to decide what it is that it is doing and explain that to you. You know, is the property being raised to your status, or are you being lowered to the status of the property?
It's called a double bind. You've got them right where you want them.
So, So I mean, it's something that they have to do. But this is some of the important points that are never addressed in the court. They drag you in there and they say, well, we want a plea from you. You know, wait a minute, I cannot enter a plea. I need to understand what is the scenario here, and they never explain the scenario to you. Okay. So then the next one, injured claimants do not consent to standing against or prosecuting property. So that means you're not going to go to court and allow that chair to argue against you. And you're not going to go to court and attempt to put that chair on the witness stand. It would be insane for you to do that.
Okay, Bert, what about, you know, the lawyer comes to court and he's the one at that moment giving life to the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not under oath, and he's presenting facts to the court, but the court can really only hear facts that are verified by a sworn witness.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, from the get-go, you would have to deal with that human being, because he's standing there saying, I'm giving this person life, this mm-hmm. you know, dead person life. And it's the same thing when a human being hires a lawyer. The lawyer goes in and speaks for that person, but the human being can't speak. The mm-hmm. judge will tell the lawyer to get your client under control. Mm-hmm. He's mentally incompetent and he can't speak in this court. He has no standing to speak in the court.
Yeah.
So what happens then? I mean, here's the lawyer presenting all this BS to the court, but none of it is sworn testimony.
Right. So here's the problem with that scenario is that you have the attorney entering into court, okay, bringing up a case on behalf of a chair, and the chair has never entered because it can't enter a verified complaint. A verified complaint is a complaint issued by the injured party and signed by the injured party. That's a verified complaint. It never happens in criminal prosecutions, and it never happens when a corporation is the one bringing the case. Who verifies the complaint? The attorney verifies the complaint.
Well, then he has to be cross-examined.
Yeah, and he cannot do that, because if he's verifying the complaint, then he's taking the position as a witness and a plaintiff and an attorney all at the same time.
Right. I have a question.
Go ahead.
Does not the injured claimant sign a contract with that corporation giving them the ability to come after him?
Yeah, so in some cases.
So who would be the complainant giving that authority to that attorney to speak on behalf of the chair?
That would have to be an official of the corporation.
Okay. So who gives the authority to speak on behalf of the chair to that official of the corporation?
I would assume that would be the injured claimant who signed the contract, agreeing to the terms.
So that would be a signature from the chair or from who?
Well, from the injured claimant. I mean, not the injured claimant, but the defendant in this case. Didn't he sign a contract with that corporation agreeing to be managed on the mortgage?
What Bert is trying to get at is that, yes, okay, so this guy agreed to be managed, okay, but who on the other side actually signed a statement that this piece of property was injured? Okay, so like how did the chair sign the statement of being a witness that this other guy who signed on and agreed to be managed by them, how did that chair sign that agreement? So somebody had to step in and act for the chair and pretend that they were the chair. You see the problem?
Okay. Yeah, I do. And the chair never signed the document.
You know, I mean, they could have put the piece of paper on the floor and then put some ink on the bottom of the chair leg and then stamped, you know, a piece of paper. I mean, that's about as far as they could go.
That person most likely never said John Jones signing for the chair. He probably just signed it as John Jones. So he takes liability.
Right. So then this is why we step back and go after the person itself and not go after the phantom corporation god that doesn't technically exist. I mean, the company exists, you know, as all these people go and work there, they all can put on their costumes or play their positions and roles and whatnot and go out and do these things, but they're still all individual people and they're still all working together. All they're doing is working under a name that they call, you know, the god of whatever name that they call that corporation.
Yeah, but the interesting thing, I think, Bert, you brought this up to me some time ago, that the definition of a corporation is it's a state entity created for the good of the public. Is that true, Bert?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bert, and you need to turn up your mic. We're barely hearing you there.
Yeah, I think you told me that you had run across that definition some time ago. And if that's the case, you know, companies like Monsanto are actually trying to injure the public. Or in the city mortgage case here, as you'll see below, they're perpetrating a fraud on the court to profit. So they're working for the injury of the people.
So then what you would do is you would show that they're working for the injury of the people and not the benefit to rescind their corporate charter. But more importantly, instead of all of these people constantly going after this fictitious entity known as Monsanto,
yeah,
they would go after each individual on the board of directors, the stockholders, the upper management of that,
yeah,
of that corporation, and stop That's messing true. Around with this stupid stuff and protesting outside and everything. Let's just drag these individuals, these men and women, or men, male and female, into the court and sue them on an individual basis for damaging crops, for hurting humankind,
yeah,
for injecting their stuff into society. And, you know, you could show damage to actual your property and farms, and you could go after each one of these guys as men and forget the corporation
Absolutely.
Altogether.
It's like a corpse. They're acting for a corpse. If you're the executor of an estate and of a dead person, you're acting for that dead person, and as the executor, you can be held accountable for misbehavior with funds and that sort of thing. That doesn't make any sense?
Yeah, it's commonly termed piercing the corporate veil.
Yeah, but the corporation itself is a dead entity. It has
yes.
no life. And so if a person dies and has no life, the executor acts for the corpse.
Stop. In other words, what Dr. Tom is getting at is forget the corporation exists.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go after
don't
the
even
actor.
Don't even, you know, whether it's police or whether it's, you know, a corporation like Monsanto or, you know, the government, whatever it is, forget the corporation and go after each man and hold each man responsible for their actions.
Yeah, by their theory, a criminal, you know, a gunman, a hitman, could incorporate himself and say, I have limited liability. You know, and who's going to buy that? They're going to go after the hitman himself. They don't care if he incorporated himself in the state of Delaware or in Nevada or anywhere else.
This is exactly what we're doing with the paperwork I'm using, protecting our land, going after the individuals.
Yeah.
And we're doing it using the RICO statutes.
Terrific.
So here's the thing, along the same lines of what you guys were saying. So going back to the example of the dog biting someone, you would never sue the dog. You would sue the owner. It would make no sense to sue the dog. So
so why the hell are you suing a corporation?
Right. So you would have to sue the owner. Now, using the example of actually being in court that you guys were talking about, bringing in an attorney. So if an attorney is protecting the or defending against the injury caused by the dog, who is the attorney really representing?
The owner.
Yeah. Is he representing the dog? No, he's representing the owner who is liable for the dog. So why would you go to court and allow an attorney to represent the property and leave the owners out of the picture? So when we're dealing with a corporation,
who in fact is the owner of that corporation.
It's one of those moments when you just kind of go, duh.
Well, it's the stockholders. But
exactly. It's the stockholders. So whoever, have you ever seen on a verified complaint signed by a stock owner?
Oh, no.
No. So, okay. So the next one in line that can have authority from the stockholders to represent their interests would probably be the CEO or one official like you mentioned earlier. So why is that official not signing the verified complaint? Doesn't make sense, does it?
Because he thinks he has limited, that he has immunity. He doesn't need to.
Yes. Yeah, so for you to go into court and accept that attorney to argue without any kind of authority makes no sense. That attorney has no authority in that courtroom to speak on behalf of this corporation, of the chair, because the owners have not given him authority.
Somebody just hired him and agreed to pay him some money.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I think happened. In Rod Class cases recently, he's been bringing that out. The attorneys there have no authority to be there. Can't represent anybody.
And they can't put any facts in front of the court without being under oath.
Yeah.
The court is receiving no facts. Related to that point is when you're dealing with the government. So the governments are all corporations. And so who do you go after when government actors send an attorney to, you know, demolish you in court when you need to go after them?
Yeah, so it's
well, who do you go after?
Well, you would go after county board of supervisors, mayor, city board of supervisors.
Yeah, but who elects the board of supervisors?
Okay, well, in that case, well, in some of those, the people would, right?
Yeah.
So then you would
sue the sheriff as well.
So you would sue the people regarding the sheriff's actions. Is that what you're saying?
Well, if New York State injures me by seizing my property, you know, the cops seize my property or whatever, state police seize my car, or because they think that I was, they planted drugs in my car, and so they're going to charge me and blah, blah, blah. That's not true. I mean, I'm just making this up as I go along. But anyway, wouldn't you sue the people of New York State as part of the defense? Wouldn't you make them defendants?
Sure, since they own the chair.
Yeah, they're the people who put those people in office and delegated the authority from from them to the governor, and then on downward from there.
Yeah, and here's where the conflict comes in.
Bert's actually done that.
Yeah. So here's where the conflict comes in with what Tom is saying is that. If you then turn around and make those owners liable for the injury that was perpetrated on you by one of their officials, employees, whatever you want to call them, then the owners basically have to step forward and say, yes, that employee has the authority and has the right to beat the hell out of you because we granted him that right. Which means that now the owners have taken the liability completely for the actions of that employee. Or the owners will come back and say, no. His authority to do whatever he can do is very limited to XYZ. And he exercised something outside of XYZ. Therefore, he is now personally liable. We take no liability for his actions.
So what you're saying is that the people... the owners of the body politic can say, no, that those actions were done outside of what we agree to, and therefore this person is solely responsible.
Exactly. And
they even have a term for that. They call it ultra vires, outside of their power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a legal term. Yeah. So if you go after the government...
Well, wouldn't we have to go after all of the government, I mean, at this point, for acting? Because they're all acting as that Latin term you just used.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're all acting outside of that. Sure.
Well, that's why a police officer, as soon as he commits a crime, he loses his immunity.
As soon as he stops you, you know, when they stop you, they put their lights on. Why do you pull over?
Well, because they're claiming that there's an emergency.
I'm asking John.
Okay.
Well, because we've been trained to do that by, and also by signing the agreement to have the license that we would follow directions of.
We're talking about the cops, though.
Yeah, I am talking about the cops.
When the cop puts his lights on, when an ambulance puts his lights on or a fire truck puts their lights on behind you, what do?
You get out of the way.
Because?
Well, that's what we've been told to do.
They have the right. They legally have the right of way. They're declaring an emergency.
I see. Okay.
So when a cop puts his lights on, he's declaring an emergency. So the whole thing is fraudulent. If he says, "Do you know why I stopped you?" You say, "You didn't stop me, officer. I was giving you the right of way, which you're entitled to get to your emergency. Do you need my help with something?" So that stop, what's called a stop, is there's no such thing as a routine traffic stop. He's declaring an emergency, but he's not taking the right of way.
See, an ambulance and a fire truck are actually going, you know, to real emergencies, whereas a policeman, you know, probably 50, 80, 90% of the time, it's no emergency except the one that he creates out of his own butt, you know.
Right. So he's committing fraud, right, by turning on his lights.
I am deeply embroiled in a case just like that right now.
Well, there you go. Now you have a whole new angle.
Yeah.
Well, I understood the business about declaring an emergency and stopping and pulling over, but
he didn't stop you. You pulled over and stopped.
Right, that's correct.
Just like I did that, for an ambulance.
And I did that because I assumed that I would be under severe stress from the bullets coming my way and the.
Well, yeah, you have this armed man approaching you.
Right.
And he's declared a false emergency. So the whole thing is fraud. He has now taken on serious personal liability. He's acting ultra vires.
Yeah, and all government officials, even those operating for the so-called military, armed forces, Navy, whatever, whatever they are doing, if it steps outside of the written authority, which can only be executed by the supposed representatives of the people, which would be the legislature for the state or the Congress for the United States. If they step outside of those descriptions, they're now acting personally liable. Now, I just put a case in there for you guys to reference. Is Little versus Barame, I think it's called. 6 U.S. 170, 1804. In this particular case, a captain of an armed ship of the United States was held personally liable and had to pay $8,000 for arresting another vessel outside of the descriptions of the Act of Congress. So it shows right there that an officer can be made liable for exercising something outside of the instructions of Congress.
Which would mean that they were acting under the color of law, right?
Yeah, well, they were creating their own law. You know? And this,
pretending like it was binding.
Yeah, and this particular officer actually was exercising an order that came down from the executive branch, from the president. And the president basically received the act from Congress, changed the wording, and then passed it down to his officers. But even though the order came from the president, which was incorrectly passed down, the guy executing it was still liable, not the president. So every officer out there that's executing a law, he better make damn sure that he knows what the heck he's executing, especially if there's a risk of him violating your right. Because even though the regulation was passed on incorrectly worded, he's still liable. And if he doesn't understand the congressional act or the legislative act, he better not enforce it.
Right, ignorance of the law and how things work is not an excuse.
There you go.
Well, it is. It actually is. They say he acted in good faith even though he didn't know the law. They say that about cops all the time.
But it's not true.
It's not true. But apropos of the cop, the friend, I think it was in California, wasn't it, Bert? Where they define the cop, he's got a fraudulent situation going. He's got a gun. He's got a stun gun. He's got restraint stuff on him, handcuffs. And the guy cooperated with the cop, even though the cop was acting in fraud from the beginning. And the definition of somebody who accosts you on the highway is a highwayman who's a robber. And they actually, you actually used that. He actually used that, didn't he, Bert, in his case, and the case was dismissed.
Mm-hmm. It was dropped by the officer himself.
Yeah.
Are you talking about Bob's case?
Yes, uh-huh.
Right, so those who want to know more about that specific case, listen to Bert and my recent episode with Bob called The Highwaymen. On
I need to listen to that.
Right.
That's the cop.
I think I sent that to you
bumping.
Yesterday, John. Sorry,
I'll
go ahead.
I'll double check it.
What, yeah. Tom?
That's what happens when a cop turns his light on and pulls up behind you. Instead of going to as an emergency, he's acting like a highway robber. And he's
I was
armed.
Looking for something to approach that, and I couldn't really find anything exact words in it.
Yeah, well, that's how it's defined. A highwayman is a robber.
Mm-hmm. That's what it means.
It's up. The definitions are up on the website for that episode, John. It's you'll find Bouvier's dictionary and everything right there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
So moving on with this thing. So the next one says the supposed plaintiff's attorney should be disciplined and their case dismissed while granting the remedy requested by the injured claimant based on the following undeniable facts. So if this court has any kind of jurisdiction, okay, then they would have to dismiss the attorney's case and provide the injured claimant the remedy that he demanded in the original case that was in the state court, which was now moved over to the federal court. Okay, so the court officers have fraudulently, and I'm talking about the attorneys, accessed this court by knowingly presenting property as a legitimate plaintiff. I mean, this is a fact. Okay. That's supported by the very papers that those attorneys have filed.
And so they're doing this every single case that goes on where a corporation is a defendant or plaintiff or whatever against the public. Every single one of these are fraudulent.
Yeah.
That's why all these people losing stuff and property from all these credit card cases is nuts.
Oh, yeah. That's crazy. That's a huge scam. But that's why the judge, I think, does so much work for the attorneys. On behalf of the attorneys, because the attorneys really can't defend any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it's just a huge money-making scam, like we revealed early on with the court clerk and the court of record, et cetera.
Right.
Yeah.
People are scared of judges, so the judge does all the talking, and the attorneys basically don't have to do a whole lot.
Yeah, and the judge is really not supposed to be doing all that talking, because the judge is also taking a big risk when he's blabbing. Because if he's stepping out of his position as a judge and now acting as a prosecutor or defending attorney, well, now he's practicing law from the bench, which he cannot do. So on the next one here, we're saying that the attorneys misrepresented the $75,000 threshold in order to access jurisdiction of the court. Okay? And have provided no proof of that $75,000 threshold. Now, this is in order to access a district court, you're supposed to have show some kind of an injury or damage of $75,000. And these attorneys actually used information from the people they were suing to claim the $75,000 threshold. And they tried to say, well, we have a $75,000 threshold because the people that were suing had a $75,000 claim in their paperwork, blah, 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 blah. But they themselves had no claim. and they try to misrepresent their
position. So what they did was they used a begging the question fallacy or circular reasoning to support their whole argument. They're going to the other side and then using their argument as their own stuff to support the whole thing.
It's brought up on the court is what it is. That's how circular reasoning can work. It can be very effective. So.
Mm-hmm. But the funny thing is that even if you look at any paperwork from the other side, there is, in fact, no $75,000 appearing there anywhere. So they completely lied. Okay. Then on the next one, we're saying that the court officers unlawfully submitted testimony through even filing an affidavit for himself.
And that's a witness.
So when you enter an affidavit, you are now acting as some kind of a witness that's testifying. Because his affidavit can now be rebutted by another affidavit.
And he can't be acting as an attorney at that point.
Yeah.
Conflict
so then, I mean,
of interest.
Yeah, I mean, this is just insane. But this kind of stuff they do day in and day out.
This should be on Saturday Night Live. This is so laughable. It really is.
Amazing.
And then the attorneys, the only thing that they actually entered, which is on the next point, so, you know, the court officers have requested a remedy on behalf of themselves for $10,000, which is attorney fees, which falls short of the federal $75,000 threshold. So they're bringing in a case supposedly based on a $75,000 threshold that doesn't exist, and then they're asking for $10,000 worth of attorney fees.
And they belong in the small claims court.
So the only provable claim of damages could be the $10,000, but that's not even provable damage because that's attorney fees.
Well, you know, and again, it's circular reasoning, because if they created the whole thing in the first place, they can't then subsequently claim damages to something that they manufactured to begin with.
Yeah.
Right. They've injured themselves.
That's what I was saying, that this would apply to all the stuff you're trying to teach people. You know, because it's contradictory to logic.
Well, and people really need to realize, you know, and I think, Bert, the issue is that your Skype auto-adjust for the volume might be checked. You might want to verify that it's unchecked and turn it up a little bit. But and now I just lost my train of thought. But anyway,
we're talking about circular reasoning,
right? Sure, circular reasoning, and people need to grasp that whenever you see a contradiction, there is either an error or a lie. Now, rather than just saying, you know, oh, we live in a quantum physics insane asylum or Roger Rabbit land, you know, what we need to do is realize that these contradictions are lies. And then go out there and seek the grammar, the who, what, where, and when, so that we have enough information to bring clarity. We don't just say, you know, oh, we just give up. It's just like you guys, you're getting down through the grammar to the facts of how all of this stuff works so that we can move forward in a real manner. But if we don't have that grammar, you know, we're left to, you know, whatever nonsense out there, and we can't make valid, clear decisions about it. But it all comes down to essentially doing your grammar and you know, knowing what you're approaching and not allowing these people to use these fallacies to, you know, to trick us, essentially. And so, you know, one of the key things that Bert and I have often talked about, and I think you and I have talked about it as well, Tom, is that, and Clint for that matter too, is that people continually just approach this stuff like they already know it, rather than approaching a new subject that you're completely incompetent.
Yeah.
And then going out there and asking the questions who, what, where, and when before we try to determine why. How the hell can you determine why something is if you don't have who, what, where, or when?
Well, this document addresses the who question. You don't even have to get to the others, because this whole document about who is this plaintiff, this corporation, City Mortgage, who is that? And that's what we've been discussing.
Right.
You know, so if you start with the who, you may never have to get to the other side. But to get standing, you have to do the who first. Who am I in this court, and who are you in this court?
And what are we here for? What are they bringing in?
You don't get to that until you decide who you are. Can you be in this court? Do you have standing to be in this court?
Well, and that would also fall under where, because if you're where, then you should be saying, okay, well, where am I? Okay, and if that whole thing comes together to reveal that you shouldn't be there. But the problem that, you know, what I was trying to get at is that people just approach all of this stuff thinking that they know what it means without a Black's Law or Bouvier's Dictionary and without looking up the words and the definitions, assuming that the words you and I use in the common public, in the common domain, are valid in the legal domain, and they're
right.
Totally not.
Totally,
you know,
not. Yeah.
So, you know, we have to approach it as though we're completely incompetent and then be like little children. Ask the basic questions: who, what, where, when, then why, then how.
Those are the journalist's old questions.
Those basic questions are the foundation of all knowledge in the universe.
Yeah, looking for truth. Yeah. Yeah. But now that's not true in journalism anymore. They start off with three paragraphs of creative writing.
Well, you start off, you know, you appeal to some false authority like the State Department, press office, whatever. And then you pick up the Reuters feed or the Associated Press feed and you let go all of your investigative journalists and you hit print.
Yeah. Apropos of, you know, the people thinking they have knowledge, I think one of the things, I think more that they believe that the governing the truth and in a court.
Well, sure,
the lawyer knows what they're doing, and of course they do. They do know what they're doing.
Well, they do know what they're doing in a fraudulent way, but the issue is that they're, you know, when you approach things that you already know what's up or you believe that this group is in your best interest, then what you're doing is you're using the ad verecundium fallacy or the appeal to authority fallacy, and then you're just handing your thinking over to these people. You don't actually go in and look this stuff up and stand as a man and protect yourself from this nonsense. You just walk in there submitting yourself to their fraudulent willpower.
Yeah, well, that's what people do when they hire an attorney. According to the legal dictionary, Juris Secundum, that if you hire an attorney, you are mentally incompetent and you are a ward of the court. So you turn your entire brain, no matter how much butter you eat, if you have a very good buttery brain, it doesn't matter if you hire an attorney.
Exactly. So, you know, don't hire an attorney. Stand as a man. Learn what courts you're supposed to go in, and don't sue property. Why the hell have people been suing chairs? Hello. Stop suing the dog and the chair and get up and sue the owner and the master, you know, and that's...
And somebody said, was it you, Bert, said the other day a chair with a broken leg has no standing by definition? Something like that.
That was Stephen.
Stephen, that's right.
He said the chair told the table, hey, you have no standing here. You're missing a leg.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Sure. Now, let's get into this Amendment 14 passed by Congress in June 13, 1866, ratified July 9, 1868. What do you guys want to talk about that?
We're in G.
Are we in G or in F? I thought we were down there now.
We're in F.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You passed E and F.
Well, okay, Bert hit E a second ago, so my bad then. Let's back up.
Okay, so on E, it said that the court office misrepresented. Oh, this was another lie that's specific to this particular case. So the attorneys misrepresented a non-existing foreclosure issue. Such issue was admitted to be an error only because the injured claimants disclosed it to the courts. And this is actually a typical behavior of attorneys. They will bring in some fact, like Tom said, through their own testimony, okay, and then they're basically causing a prejudice situation between you and the referee. I mean, that's improper behavior of the attorneys. So this guy was trying to prejudice the judge by saying that there was already a foreclosure in progress, which we then said there is no such thing. If there is, let the attorney bring forward the proof. And then he changed his mind and said, yeah, that was an error. There's, in fact, no foreclosure going on. You know, so this is just to highlight that they can, that they lie. Don't let them get away with anything. Okay, so an F, the court officers have brought an inanimate plaintiff onto this stage. And by the way, all courts are stages, okay, where you play an act, which does not meet the limitations of Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution for the United States of America due to the undeniable fact that their supposed client or plaintiff is property which cannot stand in any court as a citizen of the United States within the meaning of the Constitution for the United States, or within the meaning of the Articles of Confederation, unless the federal courts are now placing citizens on the level of property.
Bum, bum, bum.
But anyway, so in G now it says, the court officers have brought an inanimate plaintiff onto this stage which does not meet Amendment 14th passed by Congress in 1868. It is an undeniable fact that City Mortgage Inc. is neither born nor naturalized in the United States.
That is a great line.
Unless being born means created on paper by men, and such meaning is embraced by this court.
That was fantastic writing.
Bert is a corporate abortionist.
there's an in for you.
Corporate. Oh, that's good. Why don't we call the this episode corporate abortion?
Well, yeah, there you go.
I like that. So then here's the other part to this thing. It is an undeniable fact that City Mortgage Inc. is not a freed slave upon which the citizenship created by the 14th Amendment can be vested on, unless the court officer attorneys are claiming that City Mortgage is a freed slave and this court accepts such claim.
I think that's brilliant. That gets them between a rock and a hard place. Either they have to come out in full fraudulent regalia, or they have to find some way to get rid of this thing.
Now, you can use this. You're using this because you can write it this way because you're in a federal court, right? If I'm in a state court or dealing with a traffic issue, I can't really use that wording, I don't think.
Well, a state corporation isn't a 14th Amendment citizen either.
No, it's not.
So you could, in other words, he's saying you could use this because state, county, city, et cetera, they're all corporations, right?
I've just kind of been told that you can't bring Constitution into these matters.
Well, no, see, here's the issue is you don't walk into number one, you have to verify the court's jurisdiction. Number two, you have to file the counterclaims, because if you don't file, you know, anything that you put on the counterclaim is then admissible in the court. But if you don't put it in the counterclaim, you're only playing by the other side's rules. So if you walk into the court on a tax evasion charge and the IRS and their lawyer stooges who have created their own witnessing for this chair called the IRS, as you know, if they come in and say you have hurt them, they have, you know, you are filing a counterclaim and you enter all of these constitutional laws, et cetera, regarding them as men and property and the Constitution not having any right. But if you don't enter all of that stuff into your counterclaim and file it with the court before the hearing, then when you walk into that hearing, only the stuff that they have submitted is admissible in the ball court.
Yeah, in an appeal. Yeah, if you were to appeal it. But you would have
to file it in the counterclaim, though, wouldn't you? To make that becomes your law. You're introducing your law.
Right.
And so you can use the Constitution.
See,
you can use the Bible.
Right. That's my point that Tom just made very perfectly clear there, is that when you file your counterclaim, anything that you file in that counterclaim then becomes law, okay, your law. But if you don't file a counterclaim, you are bound by their law. So you can file natural law, common law, biblical law, unwritten law, which all of you and your friends agree with, unspoken law, or you know, whatever, you all walk on a certain path all of the time when it's been that way for 20 years, and all of you and your friends come in and you agree, yeah, that's our unspoken, unwritten law that we all use this walkway to get from point A to point B or whatever. So yeah, then now, let me becomes the law.
Yes. So let me give you an example. Let's say Jan here is accused.
Could I just interrupt you for a minute? I want to ask John. John, you were mentioning that you've heard you can't introduce the Constitution. After this just few minutes of discussion, do you understand that you can?
I do.
By doing the counterclaim, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, great. I just want
to finding the exact point to introduce that. My little ticket thing was dismissed. I got that dismissed.
Sure. Well,
the person that was riding in my car did not. He's now going into some kind of negotiation. They've not set a. They're not going to court yet, so to speak.
So he was a rider, right?
He's just riding with me. Yeah.
Okay. So why did they attack him? Under what authority?
There was no authority. They just opened the door and attacked him.
Well,
beat the crap out.
Let him file a counterclaim.
That's assault.
Yeah. And of course.
Did you want to, without mentioning any names or anything, did you want to tell the audience what happened there, or should we leave that for another time?
We could actually do another episode just on that particular point. But here's the highlights that's important from this case without going into the details. Okay, John was behind the wheel of his carriage, whatever you want to call it, you know, his particular model of automobile. Okay, he was responding to flashing lights, which was an emergency situation. The officer who initiated the emergency notice, in fact, was not under a real emergency. He was just simply using the emergency lights to cause this man, under false pretenses, to pull over to allow the officer to make contact with him. Once he made contact with him, he then proceeded to establish John's position as a commercial driver. Okay? Then these police officers proceeded to establish the rider in his car as a passenger. Okay? Now, if the passenger was in fact a passenger, just under the rights that a passenger has, he could beat those cops. Now, without taking the position as a passenger, just simply as one of the citizens within the meaning of the United States Constitution, sitting as a rider in that car, what authority, what right did those men have to even talk to that man?
And see, the issue is your friend is likely going after, you know, and they're actually deputies under an unlawful sheriff. But what is actually happening here is this guy is probably trying to go after the sheriff's department and the county and all of this kind of stuff, rather than holding these specific deputies responsible for their actions as highwaymen.
No, we haven't gotten to that point yet. We're definitely going to be holding them accountable.
Okay.
But that's from the first, from what my education has been so far. But we can do another one on this. I actually have a recording of the first 6 minutes of the stop. You can hear it.
Mm-hmm. And here's another point for you, John. You can claim that you were, in fact, because your friend was sitting in your car, which in most places, in most states, is considered an extension of your home, you were responsible for his safety. And you were unable to ensure his safety due to the fact that your ability to repel the assault was overwhelmed.
That's great.
See, I told you we'd get all of this, give you some new angles on all of this nonsense for a real quick time, you know?
So you could bring your own case against those officers.
Oh, I know. I absolutely am. I intend to. I have to write my complaint to submit to the sheriff by the 20th.
And not only that, but you're going to be suing the sheriff directly as well because they are his employees, number one. And then number two, you go and he, you know, technically the position of sheriff is supposed to be lawfully and he is unlawful. So you go after him for that, and then you go after the deputies individually.
Well, there's more than that. It's the sheriff has trained them to act in this way.
Well, sure.
We also have the Board of Supervisors to go after.
Well, sure.
And mm-hmm. County Council and
but
all that
stuff. Remember, go after them individually and not right. as groupthink.
Yeah. Now, here's another piece of evidence that you would really want to have. The policy manual for that police department.
Oh, cool. Okay. I think I can get that.
Yeah, you can get it in discovery.
And then make sure that you get the county charter and whatever else you can get, for all of this stuff. I mean, Clint has found amazing stuff just reading through the county charters and whatnot on their authority and what they can and can't do and how things fall. So, just reading through that, you may glean more information that would be useful to you.
Yeah, so okay. Let me show you a chain of connections here. Their policy would have to be based on their codes or statutes, correct?
Yes.
And their codes and statutes would have to be based on what?
Well, state law.
Well, no, they're based on corporate codes.
No, wait a minute. No, I'm talking about lawful here.
Okay.
If we're going to
follow,
then
they're based on the consent of the people and the jury, right?
Which, when the consent of the people, which would have to be the Constitution, right?
Right.
And that Constitution cannot be in direct opposition to what other Constitution?
Sure. Well, and not only that, but the current sheriff, who is their employer, is in violation of the state Constitution and the county charter.
Well, you're dealing with two state constitutions here, the 1879 and the 1849.
Okay, and here's another point for you to think about that since you brought it up. Did the latest Constitution for that particular state amend the previous Constitution?
You mean supplant it?
Yeah.
It did not supplant it.
Okay, so then both are still effective.
They are both still effective.
Exactly.
Right.
There's it's another like aspect to this, too.
The Constitution didn't supplant the Articles of Confederation. Yeah.
No, right. And there's another aspect here, too. Is that they're under the Highway Safety Act. Remember that all these things have been federalized because they're taking federal money, which means that they stop me on private land. Since they're federalized, they can only stop me on government-owned land, United States land.
Oh, well, that brings a whole different issue.
It does.
But I'll just give you a piece of warning. Don't get too involved in the minutiae of acts. Okay? Begin always with the basic principles of law, and then try to get the constitutions to back you up, and then you can use their statutes to show how they violated their own immediate statutes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The other thing, this is like what we were dealing with yesterday, Bert, with the bank manager and the regional manager. The federal law doesn't apply outside of the federal territory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you... John, if you read that act, the federal act, you're going to find in the definition section that person means a corporation, a trust. It has the same definition throughout federal law. And it also will include, the definition of person will also include individual. And an individual is defined in Title 5 of, and I think it's Section 2201, as a federal employee. So there, the federal law really has no jurisdiction outside of the United States, which is defined as the District of Columbia.
Right. Now you get...
So the federal law, I wouldn't worry about it too much. I'd be very aware of what it was and then make the case to yourself, at least, that it's being misapplied.
And then understand that that is the whole point of the sheriff in there.
Yeah, that's right. That's the whole point of the sheriff. They can't bring a foreign law in without the sheriff's permission.
Right, so that's why this unlawful sheriff is allowing all of these federal laws in, and that was the whole point of having an order taker in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, since you guys are bringing up the word person in the U.S. Code, the actually there's the very first section of the U.S. Code, Title I, Section 1. People need to read that because it tells you what person is in every act of Congress. There it is.
Good.
In every act of Congress, that's what person and whoever includes. And they're telling you right there what it is. So
you know, that it goes back to it all being consent and, you know, allowing this ad veracundium fallacy to go on where we just appeal to other people's authority to tell us what this stuff means, rather than going out, looking up Black's Dictionary, looking up what a person really is, realizing that it doesn't apply to us. You and I, when we are in conversation, we can say that person over there, etc. But whenever you're discussing law or anything else, you have to realize that it's solely based on the Bouvier's and Black's Law Dictionary, and that our common language bears nothing whatsoever on their legalese. And so once we get that, you know, then we can focus on what the words actually mean and how they're using them against us. And then when we stop using that ad veracundium fallacy or that appeal to authority, and we stop placing why without any information before who, what, where, and when, then we can actually put those back in order and get who, what, where, when, then why, then how. And that way, like Bert and Tom are showing us, we're actually going out and reading the Dred Scott decision and this whole thing and going through all of these different laws and realizing what these things actually mean. And then we are competent to stand as men against these chairs and this property that is out there to steal our stuff, you know, in the guise of chairs and property. So, which are really these corporate criminals hiding behind that stuff. So rather than going after the chair, from now on, we go after the corporate thug, you know, the guy who's hiding behind the corporation. We go after the Wizard of Oz himself, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think in terms of the sheriff, it's very important to know that if you read the federal laws that they say are applicable on, you know, the land of the state, the landmass of the state, they're not. So sheriffs need to know what the definitions in the federal law are, because he's applying federal definitions to local people who have no standing to be governed by those statutes.
Sure. And it's actually the sheriff who consents to any federal authority in his jurisdiction or in his county. So it is the sheriff, the supreme law of the land, who decides all of that stuff. And, you know, and again, he is the supreme elected law officer in nearly every place in the country. There's a couple places where it's different. And then as the supreme law officer, all other law code enforcement officers, etc., fall under him, whether they be police or deputies, because he is the supreme law of the county. He's the only one that's elected. All of those that fall under these city corporations, these appointed officers and police chiefs, etc., they don't answer to the people. They are employees of that corporation. Okay, so then since the sheriff is the supreme law of the land, they do actually have to answer to him. And they try and basically trick the sheriff and trick the public, make everybody think that they're separate, etc. But the sheriff does have full jurisdiction over the PD.
Yeah, unfortunately, bribery works. So you'll see...
Yes, it
you'll
does.
You'll see... I think you sent me some pictures of sheriffs who are not going to act unconstitutionally, but they're all garbed in very expensive armor provided by Homeland Security. So, you know, if you take a bribe, you're expected to cooperate with whoever has given you the bribe. You can look on YouTube and see, you know, police arriving at people's homes, the marked sheriff on the side of an armored tank. So, you know, the bribery is a great temptation even for the sheriff. Boys like toys. They like new toys.
Well, which brings up the point. I mean, doesn't it say somewhere in the Constitution that you're not supposed to have a standing army?
Exactly.
It does.
Yeah. And so, you know, and so military officials who say that they're oath keepers and they are in the military, you need to realize that if you are an oath keeper and actively in the military, you are violating your oath. There is no standing army allowed. We have the militia and the sheriff, and that is the entire point.
That's right. Yeah. So the Oath Keepers, I'm waiting to see when the line is drawn in the sand in reality to what they do. But
well, they're defining this very narrowly, because I'm even thinking about the Constitution and the oath I took and saying that I need to defend that Constitution, as really that oath, I don't think the oath should even be taken. I don't think that we're,
well,
I don't know. I was thinking about it the other day, and I'm just kind of very confused about it. I don't think that it actually really exists in that form.
Well, here's the point, because I was in the Coast Guard, and I had to take an oath. Although, you know, the Coast Guard actually falls under the Department of Transportation, and I learned that like a month or 2 months after I actually joined the Coast Guard, you know,
yeah.
and they tried to threaten me with going to the brig, and I'm like, no, you can't. I'm in the Coast Guard, bud. I'm a civilian.
That's right.
So don't pull that nonsense on me, and they didn't know what to say. But anyway, here's part of the propaganda. Like, we've all heard, you know, the war in Iraq, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was never a war.
No, it was never declared by Congress.
No, so it was a police action. So if it was a police action, those people in uniform are acting as what? As policemen.
Well, enforcers of U.S. policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're policemen.
Cops. Yeah.
They're
enforcing U.S. corporate policy on a foreign entity that's not under their jurisdiction by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
Well, Iraq understood that, because they said after, was it 2011, mid-December 31st, 2011, they would start prosecuting soldiers for war crimes. And that's when the war in Iraq ended. Obama pulled them out. Was that 2011 or 2012?
Seems kind of silly, since they bombed the hell out of them, and then you could just do it again if they wanted
to. Yeah. But I mean, people understood that they had absolutely no authority to be there, and they were going to be tried as criminals.
And so then what we need to do from now on, every time one of these police actions takes place, is then sue the president and these generals, et cetera, individually.
Yes.
Well, of course, we don't have standing, because it doesn't affect us directly. Remember?
Well,
here's the thing: is they're they're using our tax, our money that they're stealing from us to do all of these things, so we can show that there is damage there. I think
all those arguments were made already against Obama. They were all you know what? The judges are protecting them. That's the point.
Well, then how do we get around that? We'll have to figure out something, Bert.
Oh, there's ways to get around it. You just need to find an injured party.
Right.
Well, they did their best. I know they did. I know. What was that lady's name? The woman attorney that's down here in...
Ortiz or something like that.
Blonde
lady who's a dentist.
Right. Well, she's actually more than that. I don't know if you know her history.
She's a Russian.
Yeah, she came out of the Soviet Union, subject to communism. And
she's a dentist and
Israel.
An attorney. And
became
an attorney,
dentist, and then got to the United States and became an attorney.
Yeah.
And she said it can't stand, because she's witnessing what was going on in Russia happen here, and she damn well wanted to stop it.
Yeah.
And people just laughed at her.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right.
Let's do a quick review, and let's John and you guys can you and Jan can review.
Well, let me do it, because I'm the the least experienced, and you can pick up my errors.
Yeah.
And I would say that what we found out here was that these people that were calling themselves attorneys were coming in representing a piece of property, and that piece of property was trying to claim that it had authority to take an injured claimant's property using a circular argument, pulling it into federal court by making up damages that didn't exist, and then tried to reward themselves by claiming that the amount that they'd settle for would be $10,000. And they were saying that I'm going back to your last paragraph back there, that the rationale behind the only way that they could actually get standing is if they convoluted the meanings of the terms of men and slavery. That's what I got out of it. At least that's what I can articulate at this point.
And that you should do what whenever you have claims against you?
Oh, you should challenge their standing.
Sure, you file counterclaims, and then you do what with the counterclaims?
Submit them into court.
Well, you submit your own laws and rules into the court, because if you don't submit the rules that you want to play by as a quote-unquote sovereign, then you have to abide by the rules that they submit into the court. Now, if you consider it like this...
Well, I understood that that's what the counterclaim was.
Well, sure, and if you understand it like this, the court is a ball court. Let's make it a tennis court, okay? And let's say the other side, it's just any kind of ball court, and the other side wants to play one kind of game, and you want to play another kind of game, but only they brought a specific kind of ball and racket and whatever to the court, so then you can only play that specific kind of game. But let's say you decide to show up and bring, you know, soccer balls and racket balls and tennis rackets, you know, and all of these different things that can be played in a court, a basketball court, etc., and you bring all of those things. Now, you have all of these tools at your disposal rather than just what the other team says you can play with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, doesn't that relate to the court you're in, the court of general jurisdiction versus a limited jurisdiction?
Bert?
Exactly. If they want to get you into a court and they say, we want you to play hockey, and you're like, no, 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 I'm sorry. I don't know how to play hockey, but I know how to play basketball. So let's convert this court into a court of basketball. And they're like, oh, we can't because this court can only play hockey. And you're like, okay, well, then I'm on the wrong court.
Yeah, I got that. That's good.
So, you know, our ignorance of the laws and rules, I mean, you know, we consent to all of this stuff. And just because we're ignorant of it doesn't mean that we didn't consent. And so now it's getting everybody aware of their consensual action and all of this stuff and stop it and then bring back, you know, lawful sheriffs, et cetera, so that we at least have some sort of buffer. Because right now I think... You know, it's pretty ridiculous to consider just overthrowing the entire thing. You know, we need to work with the tools that we have right now in front of us and then work forward from there, you know.
I firmly believe that we have all the tools we need. It's just a matter of education.
Exactly.
And the government is rushing as fast as it can and doing the worst it can to us to avoid us from learning that education. And, of course, that's what Common Core is all about. Completely yeah. eliminates our ability to learn this. Stuff.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Trivium totally counters.
Yep.
But why don't we wrap this up with asking Dr. Tom, what is the single most important question you think people should take away from this episode?
Well, we've covered a lot of ground. I think the most important thing would be that the sheriffs be educated to the fact that federal laws, if you read them and use the definitions for the statutes and federal laws, you will find that basically even the sheriff can't apply those laws. They apply to the District of Columbia and the states. So to say something's been federalized, that's an imaginary thing. So when you get right down to the words of the statutes, it only involves persons, government employees, the United States, which is defined as the District of Columbia, a state with a capital S, which is defined as the District of Columbia or a territory of the United States. I think sheriffs need to be made aware of that if the Fed says, you know, here's a new tank and you have to, you know, put these laws into effect, that he needs to know that those laws can't take effect. And he has no authority from the people to put them into effect. I should say, thanks for the tank, but I can't do anything else for you.
Right. And that's exactly right.
They're dumb, too. They don't know any of this stuff.
Sure.
Yeah, they have to be educated for sure.
Right. All right. Paul says if they've got a tank, you need a bigger one. If they've got a howitzer, you need a bigger one.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, John, as you're coming in here as a member of the audience and picking this stuff up, what is the single most important to you to take, you know, for the audience to take away from this episode?
Oh, this idea of property. I think that's significant. It really changes people's thinking.
And Bert?
Well, my main point to get across to people is remember who you are, who you're supposed to be. If you're going to be a party to this body politic known as the United States of America, then by all means, take the highest status, which is a citizen, according to the meaning of the Constitution for the United States. Don't accept the lower one.
Don't be a chair or a piece of property. And don't license yourself away into that position.
Yes.
Can't you say that the Article 4, Section 4 of the Articles of Confederation is a higher status than the citizen of the United States?
Oh, you're talking about the same citizen that we're talking about?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, the citizen, according to the meaning of the United States, is the citizen that existed prior to the creation of the Constitution, which is the citizens that were established by the Articles of Confederation.
Okay. All right.
So there you go. Mm-hmm. All right, gentlemen. I think that's a good place to wrap it up.
Oh, yeah, one other thing. I can help discuss some of those issues about the income tax stuff because I'm going through all that right now. I'm freeing myself from all that.
We should do another episode on that, however, and then really go into depth on it.
Let me just give you a brief website. All right, Weiss Paris. Weiss is spelled W-E-I-S-S and Paris like Paris, France, .com. Right. It is a complete revocation and a way to deal with your income tax.
Sure. All right, well, let's focus a whole episode on that and not mix this one up too much. Anything else, guys?
That's it for me.
That's it for me.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you letting me sit in on this.
Nice to meet you, John.
Thank you to everybody.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.